Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is protests in Cuba. With me to discuss the historic protests that swept across Cuba on July 11th are Paul Angelo and Carmen Sassine. Paul is a fellow for Latin America Studies here at the Council. He is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. He served in the U.S. Navy and is now a commander select in the U.S. Naval Reserve. Carmen is a journalist based in Miami. She has been reporting for NBCNews.com and NBC Latino for almost a decade. She covers Cuba and Latin America more broadly, as well as U.S. politics and the Latino vote. Paul and Carmen, thanks for joining me today.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here with Carmen.
Carmen, I want to begin with you, if I may. I noted just a moment ago that earlier this month, we had historic protests all across Cuba. Could you give us a sense of where things stand now, several weeks later?
Right now, people are not protesting any longer. There's still a police presence on the streets, not as strong as it was immediately after the protests. There are almost 600 people that are still detained. Some of them are reportedly being held incommunicado, and some allegations of minors having been detained. So people who are 15, 16, 17 years old.
Now, do you make anything of the fact, Carmen, that people are not going back out in the streets?
I think right now people are afraid to go back out on the streets. I think people are very focused on the detentions, who has been detained, who has received a summary trial and sentenced to maybe a year in prison. I think that's the focus. I think the protests were so unexpected that people are still kind of regrouping, analyzing what happened, taking a step back and seeing how they can move forward. But there's definitely fear to go out in the streets again to protest.
Paul, let me bring you in here right now. Maybe you could help us understand the scope of the riots, but just as important, why you think they happened now.
Sunday, July 11th was an unprecedented and historic day in Cuba and something that historians will be talking about for decades in much the same way that we talk about the Mario boat lift or the Maliconazo in 1994. And it was an unprecedented display of displeasure on an island where such displays have historically been taboo and met with repression, where discontent is often expressed in whispers. I'd say that the recent protest movement is unique, in particular given its pervasiveness. It wasn't a protest that was isolated to just one city or province, but people took to the streets all over the country. And when the protests first started, the humanitarian climate was very much front of mind. This particular moment initiated in Matanzas, an area of the country that's facing major shortages in medical supplies, and also an area of the country where a COVID infection rate is about three times the national average. And when videos started circulating on social media depicting the overcrowding of hospitals and overwhelmed medical staff, the hashtag SOS Matanzas started trending on social media and was the initial impetus for people to come out to the streets and start making demands of their government.
Carmen, I want to get back to the issue of the enabling causes and the context in which the protests took place. But I'm curious if you could just sort of spell out for us, do we have a sense as to whether these protests had a leader or leaders? Was it organized or was it somehow the right sort of social media messages passed on the Cuban version of the internet and poof, we have protests?
I think it was very spontaneous and very unorganized. Definitely there was no leader in organizing this protest. It began in a small town because of social media. You know, one person started live streaming the protest in this small town, and people in other parts of the country just became inspired to go out and protest as well. And it just had a ripple effect. And you started seeing protests in province after province, in small towns, big cities. So definitely no organization to this. On one hand, I've heard a lot of experts say that this is bad because, you know, there's no leader, there's no leadership. They don't have a united message. They were all protesting for different reasons with different ideologies. But on the other hand, it can be positive for them to not have a leader because what Cuba has done in the past is often jail dissident leaders. For example, Jose Daniel Ferrer from Umpaku, he has not only been jailed, but they also vilify dissidents often in the media. So they will run 2-hour programs in their state-run news program saying how these people have been financially backed by the United States, but also they have been directed by the State Department to form unrest or whatnot. So, you know, some experts agree that it's good for them to not have had a leader in this organization of protests.
Well, I have to ask then, Carmen, given that we had this sort of spontaneous and rather disorganized protest that sort of sprung up, was there any consistency in what the protesters were demanding? Were there their demands primarily economic? Were they political? Were they aimed at human rights? Were they more narrow, like we want better internet service or access here in our particular town? Any consistencies about the message that the Cuban people were sending on July 11th?
I think it was all of that. Definitely the dire economic crisis in Cuba is what sparked the protest. They felt a certain pressure for them to feel that they're no longer fearful to go out and protest, that you know, the situation is so bad that they're willing to put their lives at risk. So the Cuban government has such a tight hold on all aspects of life on Cuba that everything is intertwined. The chance for freedom, the chance for we want change, patria y vida, all these chants and the protests about food shortages and shortages in medicine, they're all intertwined. The Cuban government has a tight hold. It owns every industry practically. It determines the wages that people earn. It determines how much you pay for internet. It determines what gets imported. They are the sole importers of food and medicine and other goods. So people want to break free from this because they feel that it's because of the Cuban government that they have all these shortages, that they cannot write certain things on social media, that they get harassed if they show political opposition. So I feel it's all intertwined.
I have to ask you, Carmen, for our non-Spanish speaking members of the audience, could you translate Patria y Vida?
Okay, so patria y vida translates to fatherland and life. So that's kind of a play on a very famous slogan from Fidel Castro, the late Fidel Castro, which is patria y muerte, fatherland or death. So basically telling the population, you know, you choose between fatherland or death, or you die. So these rappers, some of them based in Cuba, some of them based here in Miami and Spain, came up with this song called Patria y Vida, fatherland and life. Like, why can't you have both? Why can't you live in your country and enjoy it and have your life as well? So that has been a very important slogan in the demonstrations. They chanted Patria y Vida many times, and it's really become kind of a slogan of the protests.
Oh, it certainly has. And I will tell you, I live in Washington, D.C. There have been a number of protests demanding action on Cuba, and Patria y Vida has shown up on the side of many cars, in vans, and on many signs being held by protesters here. I'm curious, Paul, you're a political scientist by training. Can you put this protest in sort of in a broader context, give us a little bit of a sense of how the economy in Cuba has, as best I can tell, fallen through the floor? It has been actually declining for a number of years, but particularly with COVID-19?
Although the initial organization of the protests had much to do with the humanitarian situation, the food shortages, and the record COVID daily cases and deaths on the island, in short order, the protest movement became about everything that's happening on the island. And that's the thing about a totalitarian system. The leaders of such systems are accountable for the totality of the system's dysfunctions. And as much as this is a story about food shortages and announced electricity blackouts, this is also a story about economic underperformance. Latin America was the most adversely affected region of the world by the pandemic-induced economic contraction. And Cuba was significantly above the regional GDP contraction for 2020, sitting at around 11%. In a practical sense, this has led to inflation on the island upwards of 500%. Some estimates put that...
Did you just say 500%, Paul?
That's correct, Jim, 500%. But some estimates also put that number upwards of 900%.
Okay, that's pretty steep.
Moreover, we've seen poverty on the island surge, although it's very difficult to ascertain exactly how many people are living below the poverty line in Cuba, given the lack of transparency in such a closed system. International estimates put the number between 41% and 50% of the population. In 2020, given the interruption of supply chains, imports to the island dropped by 30%. And that's in a country that imports more than 50% of the fuel and food that it consumes. And finally, the tourism industry has taken a big hit in Cuba, and tourism has become a lifeblood for the Cuban economy. International tourists arriving on the island in the first 5 months of 2021 dropped by 90% in comparison to the first 5 months of 2020.
Carmen, can we talk a little bit about what we know of Cuba's experience with COVID-19? Cuba has a long-standing reputation for having a very solid medical system that was one of the great accomplishments of the Cuban government and one of the few accomplishments of the Cuban government. But my understanding is that COVID is now ravaging the country. Cuba has turned down offers from the international community, particularly through this multinational consortium called COVAX, to get vaccines for COVID. Can you sort of lay out for us what we know about what's happening on the island?
Sure. At the beginning of the pandemic, Cuba was able to keep the amount of COVID cases drastically low, especially in comparison to the rest of this hemisphere. Now, they took extreme measures. For example, they shut the airports for 8 months, so nobody was able to come in or come out of Cuba, except for some emergency planes to evacuate the tourists that were there and whatnot. You know, people would get heavily fined if they left their home without a mask on. If they were seen outdoors without a mask, they would get a very hefty fine. All businesses were closed. Beaches are still closed. So huge restrictions. And that kept the level of COVID cases very low. When they opened up the airports again, the number of cases began to climb. And the Cuban government blamed a lot of travel from the United States, especially among Cuban Americans, for spreading COVID on the island. So they restricted the flights from the U.S. and a couple of other countries. So they're only allowing from the U.S., the Dominican Republic, Haiti, one flight per airline per week. Obviously, that's not enough for loved ones here to take food and medicine that relatives need on the island. But they have kept this measure while keeping tourism in the resorts of Varadero open. So that's where you started to see an explosion of COVID cases. Varadero is in the province of Matanzas, which is where you have the epicenter of COVID. And yes, right now, the last few days, they've broken records of over 8,000 cases. That's actually, they have the largest per capita rate of cases in the hemisphere. And it's comparable to what Florida had during their spike in COVID cases. And that's what they're trying to control now. They have had a very good primary care system since the revolution. So you have all these policlinicas, these little clinics that are all over neighborhoods, and people can go there when they have any kind of ailments, high blood pressure, a sore throat, that sort of thing. But this is more complicated, and a lot of their hospitals are run down, and they don't have the resources to deal with the amount of cases that they're getting right now.
Paul, one thing I didn't hear you mention were the sanctions that Donald Trump intensified when he became president. How do they figure into this story of what's happening in Cuba?
Certainly the Trump-era travel restrictions and the uptick in sanctions and the limits placed on remittances that could be sent from the United States have led to economic hardship on the island. There's no doubt about that.
Okay.
And that situation has conspired with the economic contraction that I previously mentioned due to COVID-19 to make things significantly worse for everyday Cubans. The real question is whether economic hardship is enough to provoke regime change. And frankly, we haven't seen that theory of change come to fruition in 6 decades.
Carmen, I want to come back to you. You've already pointed out the steps that the Cuban government has taken in reaction to the protests of July 11th, and that has consisted of sending the security forces out, shutting down the internet to interfere with the ability of people to coordinate, and basically trying to rest on fear to get the population to behave. I'm curious, though, we're now beyond the revolutionary generation in Cuban politics. President Díaz-Canel has been president, I guess, now for 2 years, but he wasn't part of the original revolutionary generation. And what we have seen in other countries that went through revolutionary periods is that when the revolutionary leadership group passes, that politics gets more complicated. So does Díaz-Canel have the kind of legitimacy needed to sustain a repressive form of government in Cuba?
He doesn't. So that has been a major concern for many about his presidency, that he doesn't have that revolutionary legitimacy that the late Fidel Castro and Raul Castro has. People either loved them, hated them, respected them, or feared them. With Díaz-Canel, he just doesn't have that. So he has to deliver results in order to have legitimacy. And that's been an issue because Cuba approved very ambitious economic reforms back in 2011, which Raul Castro announced. But they haven't really fulfilled those economic reforms that involve more foreign investment, more private enterprise. And right now, he has to do something in order to make people content. They can speed up the economic reforms, but it's going to take a while to see the results of that. You're not going to see them overnight.
Carmen, are we seeing any signs of divisions within the Cuban Communist Party? Because obviously, if the public begins to doubt Díaz-Canel, I would imagine some members of the party might be as well.
The Communist Party of Cuba is very quiet about what they discuss and what goes on between them.
Opaque is the word that comes to mind.
So what the Communist Party of Cuba discusses behind closed closed doors doesn't really filter out. There are no leaks like we have here in the US government and things like that. Right now, we haven't seen any breaks from the Communist Party of Cuba or from the military. The military is, in any country, is very important. They basically run the tourist industry in Cuba and benefit a lot from it. They have access to money that others don't have access to products, food that others don't have access to. So I think it's going to be difficult to see a break from the military. As far as the government and what they're discussing behind closed doors, it's anyone's guess if there are people, you know, fighting back or not.
I agree with Carmen. It's really difficult to know what's happening on the inside of the regime. But what I will say is that it was extraordinary that when Díaz-Canel called upon the real revolutionaries on the island to go out to the streets and defend the revolution, the only people who were inflicting violence on protesters were state security forces. And therein lies the secret to figuring out what will happen in Cuba. State security forces, particularly the military, are part of the governing structure and will continue to hold the line. And they have a widespread network of informants and some highly sophisticated intelligence and counterintelligence services that will all but guarantee that any process of liberalization, either political or economic, will be controlled and very gradual. I would also say that it's telling that Raul Castro came out of retirement for this. In the days following the protest, Raul Castro made a rare public appearance, meaning that President Díaz-Canel, who lacks the charisma and gravitas of the Castro brothers, as Carmen rightly noted, is largely still operating with training wheels on his bicycle. There's still a probationary period to see whether or not Díaz-Canel is the person who can bring the Cuban revolution into the 21st century.
Though I will note that Fidel has been dead for a decade and Raul is 90 years old. So if anything, the revolutionary generation is very, very, very long in the tooth. But I want to come back to Washington, D.C. This, after all, is the President's Inbox podcast. I want to talk about Washington's options. You have Joe Biden, who came into office saying, in essence, domestic policy is job number one. I'm going to tackle COVID. When it comes to foreign affairs, China is my job one. Cuba didn't seem to figure prominently in the first 6 months of the Biden administration. Now we have protests. How has the Biden administration responded, Paul?
The Biden administration has pursued a rather measured policy toward Cuba to date. There was some initial optimism from progressive sectors that he might go back to the Obama-era detente, but domestic politics have been such that there's little appetite, particularly among Cuban Americans, for a resumption of such robust diplomatic and economic relations as we saw in 2015 and 2016. Likewise, the Biden administration has been deliberate about devising a policy that demonstrates support for the Cuban people and their aspirations to define their own future, while denying the regime any opportunities to strengthen its own hand. So far, this policy is focused on sticks against the regime and humanitarian relief for the Cuban people. To date, the sticks that the Biden administration has employed include things like the designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terror. The United States as well in June voted against the ending of the embargo at the UN General Assembly. And in the wake of these protests, the US government applied new targeted sanctions against members of the regime, including the Minister of Defense and the Buenas Negras, which are the special forces, were largely involved in the repression of the protesters. Likewise, just this week, the United States government led the signing of a joint statement of global democracies condemning the mass arrests and the summary trials that are taking place on the island. In terms of humanitarian gestures aimed at the Cuban people, the Biden administration is looking to increase its diplomatic posture in Havana as a symbolic measure to demonstrate solidarity with the democratic aspirations of the Cuban people. It has expressed a willingness to channel humanitarian assistance to the island through multilateral institutions, although in much the same way that the regime has blocked the access of the COVAX program to the office, the regime would likely stand in the way of any humanitarian assistance from the U.S. government. And the Biden administration is also currently in discussions with the private sector to determine how best to make the internet more accessible to Cubans on the island. Whether or not that's logistically feasible remains to be seen, given that the Cuban government could potentially jam whatever signal that the U.S. government would seek to provide to everyday Cubans. Likewise, just last week, the Biden administration stood up a working group to determine how to create mechanisms that allow families in the United States to support their family members on the island with remittances, but doing so in a way that prevents the regime from benefiting from those money flows.
There's a lot there in that list you just provided, Paul. Boil it down for us. How much of the Biden administration's reaction has been symbolic as opposed to substantive?
The Biden administration is being pressured on both sides of the political spectrum to devise policy responses to this recent protest movement in Cuba. But it's happening in a space where, practically speaking, there's very little that the Biden administration can do. On the one hand, you have voices across the hemisphere and across the globe, for that matter, insisting that the U.S. government eliminate the embargo against Cuba. But the reality is that relaxing the embargo at a time when the Cuban regime is actively and very visibly repressing its people sends the wrong wrong message entirely. Moreover, the U.S. government already allows humanitarian exceptions for the import of medicine, foodstuffs, and humanitarian goods from the United States to the island. On the other hand, you've got protesters demanding military intervention, something that even some U.S. politicians have also floated as an option. This is not a serious proposition, however, and if anything, it's a lot of political grandstanding. At a time in which we are withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, this is not especially sensible. But I would also note that any kind of military action or even military provocation in the vicinity of Cuba would corroborate the Cuban regime's claims that the United States is an imperialist nation that seeks to take over islands in the Caribbean. And it could serve to help people on the island close ranks with the regime.
Carmen, you're based in Miami. No secret, Miami has an awful lot of Cuban Americans with family back in Cuba. What has the reaction been in Miami to the protests? And what are they hoping that the Biden administration will do?
In Miami, there have been sustained protests in support of Cubans, but also demanding that the Biden administration do more on Cuba. Right now, people here feel that Biden kind of slow-walked things on Cuba at the beginning and the first days following the protests. And right now, what he's done has not gone far enough for them. So many of the Cubans that are protesting and rallying in Miami want something more provocative than sanctioning an official who's not going to travel to the U.S. anyway. They are calling for a range of things, depending on the ideology of the person. Some people are calling for military intervention. The mayor of Miami, Francis Suarez, actually called for military intervention. So you hear that from regular people as well. Other people are more moderate and are just calling for more humanitarian assistance. So there's a different array of demands that are being made for the Biden administration. And they're in a very difficult situation. Biden is in a very tough situation because whatever he does is going to have political implications here in Florida, domestic political implications.
Oh, no doubt about this. This is an issue that has important foreign policy ramifications, but it obviously has equally important political ramifications, given that Florida has been a competitive state, went Republican in 2020. Many experts credit Trump's victory in Florida to the fact he had taken a hard line on Cuba, that resonated not just with Cuban-American voters, but also Venezuelan and Colombian-American voters. I'm just sort of curious on that score, Carmen, do you see any differentiation within the Cuban-American community, particularly between older Cuban-Americans and younger Cuban-Americans? Or are they all sort of on the same part of the spectrum where they want the United States to do something tangible to try to force the Cuban government out?
Traditionally, it was the older generations, those that came in the 1960s that were the more hardliners and wanted, supported the embargo 100% and things like that. And it was thought that the younger generations or those who had come more recently were kind of apolitical, not very interested in politics, cared more about having the U.S. having relations with Cuba. Obviously, 2020 changed all of that. So all these people that have been coming from Cuba in the last 20 years were very supportive of Trump, probably the most supportive. The historic exile, those who came in the 1960s, many of them have passed away already or are very old in their 80s and 90s. So they're not the ones that are driving that conservative movement towards Trump among Cuban Americans. It's actually the more recent arrivals. That's where you see the more fervent support for Trump or for Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, things like that. And right now, they just feel that Biden isn't being proactive enough or he's not being as vocal as maybe Trump would have been. He is limited, Biden, in what he can do. There's already an embargo on Cuba. The idea of military intervention, I don't think the Biden administration has any appetite for that. So there's a lot of talk about internet as well, whether they can provide internet to Cuba. But even that, there are a lot of questions about whether that can actually be done or not. But sure, the political implications here are very high, and not just among Cuban Americans, like you guys mentioned before. A lot of people are keeping a close eye on this. So it's not just Cuban Americans. The issue with Cuba is something that resonates among Colombians, among Venezuelans, among Nicaraguans, among even Argentinians. You have a whole lot of Latinos in South Florida that were born in Latin America and have been somehow affected by socialism, Marxism, whether it was a government, a movement, or whatnot. And that's very important here when it comes to domestic politics.
Carmen, I want to follow up on that. You have noted that many members, or certainly the vocal members of the Cuban American community in Southern Florida, have been wanting wanting the Biden administration to do more, I think both substantively and symbolically. Earlier on, you mentioned that many Cuban Americans are able under U.S. policy to go to Cuba and bring goods, food, medicines, and the like. Is there any calls in the Cuban American community to end that? Because doesn't that seem to run counter to the overall U.S. embargo?
It's complicated for Cuban Americans because many Cuban Americans here in Miami have their relatives in Cuba. What you see mostly is, you know, younger people, let's say in their 40s or 50s, who have their elderly parents in Cuba. So the U.S. is one of the top exporters of chicken to Cuba. It's a top trading partner when it comes to chicken. The Cuban Americans really want that cut off so that their elderly parents have even less to eat? I don't think so. So there are certain things that Cuban Americans don't want done. The issue of remittances, I feel, has gotten so much political attention, not just here among Republicans and Democrats, but by the Cuban government as well. And in reality, here in Miami, people are still sending remittances to Cuba. They're just not sending it through Western Union. You have a bunch of travel agencies that specialize in selling tickets to Cuba, sending packages to Cuba, and remittances. And people use that to send money, or they send it through mules. These are people like couriers who carry packages or money to loved ones in Cuba. So remittances are still going there. Do they want for remittances to be cut down even further? No, I don't think so. Because again, it's that concern. What are my parents going to eat? My parents are living the last years of their lives.
Doesn't that in some way suggest that the Cuban American community is sending a mixed message? It wants the Biden administration to be tougher, but not tougher in a way that harms their family members?
Right. There are some things that they just don't want done. Florida International University has a very good poll that's released every couple of years. And when they released their poll in October, they found that a majority of Cuban Americans were in favor of ending, for example, the cruises to Cuba, but they were against tightening on other things like remittances and things like that. So yeah, it is mixed. They are sending kind of a mixed signal because at the end of the day, they don't want their brother or their sister or their parents to be suffering to the point that they don't have enough to eat. It's bad enough as it is.
Certainly. Paul, I want to come back to you and just look at the Biden administration, because I think Carmen has aptly pointed out this is a big political challenge, but also an opportunity for the Biden administration. I take your point that the Biden administration doesn't have a lot of policy tools that it can use to really pressure the government in Havana. And some of the ones it could, like we just discussed, it never would, because it would intensify the pain being felt by the very people we're hoping are going to get a better life and increase their freedoms. But I'm still left wondering, why hasn't President Biden been pounding the table on Cuba? After all, Joe Biden put democracy at the forefront of his foreign policy. He talked about how his administration was going to reverse sort of the erosion of democracy around the world and fight for its future. This would seem to be a situation in which he wouldn't be hesitating on what to do. He would be very vocal. It would probably be good policy. It's what he said he was going to do when he was campaigning. I would also imagine it would be good politics, given what we just discussed about the attitude of many voters, not just Latino voters, in Florida.
I suspect that the Biden administration was waiting for signs from Havana that the regime would be interested in a new kind of relationship with the United States. But so far, since Biden has taken office, we haven't seen any such diplomatic, economic, or political overtures from the regime in Cuba. And at a time when democracy is at risk elsewhere in the hemisphere, in a practical sense, and beyond rhetoric, there's not a whole lot the United States government can do to advance the cause of democratization on the island. And so at a time where we're seeing democracy at risk elsewhere in the hemisphere, particularly in places like Mexico or Central America, the Biden administration sees more opportunities to craft a narrative about support for democratic institutionality, the rule of law, and anti-corruption in places where it has long-standing relations with public servants, as opposed to an island like Cuba, where the United States does not have a great deal of leverage over the political leadership and doesn't have a significant enough foothold among civil society to make a serious dent or to move the dial in the right direction.
Carmen, I want to close with you. And on this issue of what Joe Biden should do, what are your thoughts about what Joe Biden should be saying, not just to the Cuban people, not just to Americans, but particularly people in South Florida?
Joe Biden has received a lot of criticism from Democrats because he has not come down to Miami and addressed Cuban Americans and given some sort of policy speech on what he's going to do, or just to show support for the protests in Cuba. That's something that actually former President Barack Obama got some criticism for as well. He never came down to Miami to sell his engagement policy on Cuba to Cuban Americans. He never addressed people here. And Joe Biden now has this quote unquote golden opportunity to come to Miami and give this policy speech. That's something, a very simple move he can make. He's not making a policy move. It's just coming down and giving a little bit of love to the Cuban American community. That would be very significant. That's something that Trump did repeatedly during his term as president. He came down repeatedly to Florida. So did Vice President Mike Pence. So did Bolton. They all came down to Miami and gave policy speeches on Latin America. That was very effective for them. And that's something very simple that President Joe Biden can do.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Paul Angelo, Fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council, and Carmen Cecine, a reporter with NBCNews.com and NBC Latino. Paul and Carmen, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.
Thanks, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.